This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland podcast, an institution in subject areas that continue to baffle and amaze those of us with an operative sense of wonder and sanctity. I'm your monthly guest, MC James Falk, host of the Neon Galactic podcast on Patreon, YouTube, and wherever else you might get your favorite podcasts. My guest today is anthropologist Jack Hunter, author of several books that deal with anthropology, ecology, the paranormal, the visionary, and the weird. As a scientist, he recognizes the challenges that face those of his colleagues who engage with borderland subjects, courting possible ridicule and the haughty dismissal of their work, yet he also seems to understand the relevance such phenomena have in the formation of our collective human identity. He works very hard to keep the blinders that come from our Western scientific worldview from ravaging his curiosity and forcing conclusions that don't fit the data. So many in science and academia today seem incapable of divorcing their perspective from a paradigm that immediately assumes a level of superiority over any cultures and traditions that accommodate numinosity, as if human culture is a linear progression and wisdom from the past or someone else always lacks vigor. But in an age when our worldview itself seems to be fueling division, ecological catastrophe, inequality, violence, and even the runaway development of dangerous technologies, isn't it time to rethink our approach? To find better ways of existing on this planet, as part of this planet, rather than as its chief exploiter and biggest threat? What goes into the establishment of worldviews, and is it even something that can be consciously amended? Where should we look for a different approach without being guilty of cultural appropriation? To my mind, these are some of the most important questions facing our species, and these themes lay at the heart of what so many are experiencing through paranormal encounters like alien contact, near-death experiences, spiritual epiphanies, and sundry. Is this the planet doing its best to communicate, the cosmos, or our own conscience as a species? And will we listen, or will we continue to pretend that we're the only minds in the universe with a stake in how this universe and the fate of our delicate planet unfolds? Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
To sort of introduce you, and correct me if these have changed since the last time we talked, but you're an honorary research fellow with the Alistair Hardy Religious Experience Research Center, and a tutor with the Sophia Center for the Study of Cosmology and Culture at the University of Wales, Trinity St. David.
That's right, yep.
Okay, great. And now, since the last time we talked, I've read another one of your books, Spirits, Gods, and Magic, An Introduction to the Anthropology of the Supernatural, which was absolutely fascinating, and I think does a good job of sort of introducing, you know, what the common anthropological approaches are to a lot of these subjects, and stakes kind of an aggressive claim, I think, in ways that we might approach it more productively. But before we get into that, I'd like to talk just a little bit about who you are, how you got into these subjects, and then we'll go on from there.
Yeah, so, I'm an anthropologist by training. So, you know, my background is in what we call social anthropology or sometimes cultural anthropology. And that means sort of, you know, studying, trying to understand contemporary human societies and cultures. So I'm dealing with, you know, people who are alive today, contemporary people, not with, you know, like in archaeology where you deal with ancient civilizations or anything like that. These, what I'm mainly interested in is people today. So I got into this when I was quite young. I've always had an interest in the paranormal, in sort of I had an interest in spirituality and religion, not because I'm religious in any way necessarily, and I wasn't brought up to be religious. In fact, I was brought up to be quite skeptical of religion. But I think in some ways that's why I've become so fascinated by it, by beliefs and by spirituality and these kinds of things, because in some ways I suppose I don't have it, or I wasn't brought up with it. So when I was in school, I was always interested in religious education. It's a class that we do in the UK where we learn about different religious traditions. And that was sort of my favorite class in school. And I pursued that with interest. And it got to the point where I was the only person in the school who really wanted to study it for A-level. It's quite an unpopular subject, and people actually opt to kind of to drop out of it. But what I found interesting was, studying people's worldviews, other ways of understanding the world, different models of reality. When you really think about it, studying different religions is a very deep kind of thing. And that led me into anthropology. I thought anthropology was actually a kind of a natural extension from the religious education that I did in school. When I was in university, I became m very interested in spirituality, spirit beliefs, and really why people believe in spirits. And this was partly because of some experiences I had earlier on in my life. I had a psychedelic mushroom experience with what I think of as fairies when I was about 16 or 17 years old. And I had other things that happened throughout my childhood. My sister said she saw fairies in the house once. And then later on, I started to ask questions about where do these kinds of ideas and beliefs come from. And anthropology seemed to be a route towards investigating that. So when I was a student, I found this group called the Bristol Spirit Lodge. They're a spiritualist home circle, a private group in Bristol, in the UK, and they were practicing trance and physical mediumship. And this group seemed to me, it was a small group, and it seemed to me the ideal kind of field, really, to investigate belief in spirits or spirit experiences. And while I was doing this, I spent about 7 years researching this group, on and off over that time, but p so some periods of really intense engagement and other periods of less intense engagement. And over the course of doing that, I had a few experiences of my own, which kind of, for me, they posed a challenge to the dominant models in anthropology. So, you get taught all of these theories when you're a student of anthropology about social functions and how social institutions and things like that exist because they do things for society, like they glue it together. Or there are psychological functional explanations, like that it helps us to fend off fear of death and all of those kind of things. But when it came to actually having this experience in the séance, I'll just tell you just one example of the kind of experience.
Please. We love it. So whatever you can share.
It was in quite an early séance, and the medium was in sitting in the cabinet, and which is a kind of like a curtained off corner of the séance room, and she went into her trance state, and I started to see these little kinds of flashes of light behind her, which I thought were, to me seemed like hallucinations. Like I said, I had a psychedelic experience earlier on in my life, so I've had hallucinatory experiences, and I think, at least at the time, I thought, I could tell when I was hallucinating, and these little flashes of light seemed to be hallucinations. And then I saw this green face, or kind of like a mask, kind of appear over the medium's face. And it had the look of a kind of stereotypical kind of Shaolin monk face, so like a bald Chinese kind of face. And it was sort of a luminous kind of green color. And it stayed on the face for a little while, and then it kind of slipped down towards her chest, and kind of, disappeared and or dissolved away, fizzled off. It didn't look to me like a very kind of physical thing, like a physical mask or anything like that. It didn't look like a projection, from a torch or something like that. Again, it had these qualities of a hallucination. So, it had that kind of feel to it. And then when we went out into the house afterwards, I kind of kept this to myself because I didn't, it was an early seance, and I didn't want people to think that I was someone who has all these kinds of experiences all the time, because generally I don't really. But Someone else then independently said, "Did anyone else see that green face?" And I had to acknowledge then that I had seen this thing, but I thought it was a hallucination. And that's the kind of thing that a standard social functional explanation of spirit mediumship, or a standard psychological explanation of spirit mediumship doesn't really accommodate that or explain. There could be other explanations that are, physicalist and things like that, but it posed a challenge to these dominant anthropological ideas anyway. And that's led me off to thinking about non-reductive approaches ever since.
I mean, can I dive into that the spiritualist experience a little bit? I mean, over 7 years, I mean, what do you th how ultimately how do you think that that has shaped your approach to other paranormal phenomenon since then? I mean, you mentioned this one experience. I assume there was probably more. Plus, I imagine you got to know the person who was the medium. It was it one person over time?
There was a group of different mediums, yeah.
I mean, so getting to know those folks and, sort of being able to weigh the likelihood of them being fraudulent through personal association. How did it shape your thinking, and where did you ultimately come down on the ontology of what you were seeing? Was it real, or was it, I mean, just to sort of pick your brain on that.
Well, I think it's real. But what real means is another kind of thing. But all of these experiences and the stories that I tell, actually were real events that occurred. But what the ultimate nature of it all is, I can't actually definitively say. But I err on the side of a certain kind of reality to it anyway. And it taught me a lot of things about the paranormal. I think one of the most interesting things for me was the other kinds of like peaks and troughs of intensity with these kinds of phenomena. When I was very, very, very first engaged and most sort of deeply kind of entwined with the subject matter, when I first started, when you're first really keen on it. The things that I saw in seances were new and exciting and novel, and it filled me with a kind of excitement about it all. And other kinds of phenomena started to happen in my life as well. You can imagine I was I was going to these seances kind of on my own in the evenings, and then returning back to my normal life, which was with my friends and students and things like that. And it was these completely different worlds. But when I was most engaged, the worlds kind of overlapped with each other, bled into each other, and I had a few weird kind of experiences, in my bedroom around the same time that I was doing this mediumship stuff. Like again, these green kind of hallucinations. The one that really sticks in my mind is this giant kind of goat's head that materialized above my bed early on, or I hallucinated, whatever it was. Okay, so there was this sort of period of real intensity. And then obviously over 7 years, there are peaks and troughs of that. And other times the whole thing was incredibly tedious and really boring, and seances are repetitive and all of these kind of things. And it really made me aware of the sort of role of our own engagement with these phenomena. And the more that we engage with them, and the more kind of the interest that we're able to kind of muster for them, the more vibrant they kind of become. But they can also kind of drift off and disappear and kind of be forgotten about as well. That's one kind of thing about the nature of the paranormal, I think, that I learned over the course of my research, is that we are quite heavily invested in it in a lot of ways. But that doesn't mean that we're just creating it. We kind of energize it as well.
I mean, do you think that it's almost like it's seeking human attention? Would you say that that's, I mean,
I think some parts of it are, yeah. I don't really like the idea that the paranormal is one
one
big
thing.
thing. And I think there are probably many, many different paranormal things. And some of them are probably, like things that want us to engage with them. Other things, paranormal things, probably really don't want any kind of engagement and try to stay as far away from us as possible. And we probably never encounter those things. And I think it's a bit risky when we start to kind of ascribe a kind of a universal consciousness to the paranormal, that it's all one kind of mind or all a manifestation of one phenomenon. I think if we look at nature, it's all alive, but it's a huge variety of diversity. And I think it's the same with the paranormal as well. It's all paranormal stuff, but there are many different strands to it and different motivations and different, stuff.
I want to follow up on that. First, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to dive back into that point. Welcome back to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. We're having a conversation about the paranormal, and I wanted to kind of jump back onto the point that we were talking about just a moment ago. We are, our culture is sort of awash in a lot of different, whether you want to call it TV shows or documentaries or books, with people sort of dabbling in various aspects of the paranormal. But there have been people who are seeking kind of a broader pattern. I mean, Jacques Vallée is someone like this, or, where they're saying like things like fairy visitations are very similar to, say, alien encounters, or that poltergeists and, people seeing things manifest in their bedrooms at night when they're asleep, sometimes those things have hitchhiker effects that are very, very similar and seem like maybe they're hinting at a common nature. How do you draw that line, and where do you, I mean, how do you, what kind of patterns do you think are important to notice, but then how do you kind of keep the differences in context?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of strands to it. One of them is like I was saying before, to kind of take an ecological kind of perspective. So you can think of an ecosystem, for example, as a single organism, and there are arguments that talk about, a forest as a single living kind of organism. Okay, so that would be a kind of oneness, unity. Mind is that it's made up of many different component parts, lots of different kinds of species that all contribute to the kind of functioning of this superorganism. So it's a kind of a mistake to think of the superorganism as a superorganism in some ways, although, it can have this kind of overarching behavior and things like that. But when you look into it, it's actually many different parts. And I think there's a kind of reductive quality to the idea that the paranormal is all one thing. I think when we look into it, when it's quite obvious on the surface of it as well, that there are different strands to it. But that doesn't mean that they're not connected to each other. And I think this is the other aspect of it. When you have this system, it's kind of interconnected. These things kind of relate to each other, and they're not separate from each other, but they're still different things. They're related. And I think the things that connect these phenomena in a lot of ways are the kinds of underlying processes and the kinds of the things that have to happen in order for certain kinds of phenomena to occur, or for certain kinds of experiences to happen. So I'll give one of what I mean by this is a good example is sort of human, the way that human beings respond to stimuli. So we that we there are similar kinds of responses that we have to different kinds of things out in the world. And this is one of the things that I like to talk about, is how there are all sorts of interesting accounts of human beings having interactions with flesh and blood animals, like dolphins, for example, or chimpanzees, or whatever, but experiences with animals that we absolutely 100% empirically know exist. And these experiences that people have with these animals, go have the whole spectrum, all to awe and wonder and all of this kind of stuff that comes from interactions with these things. And you see the same kinds of responses when people describe interactions with, ghosts and paranormal things. So it's not saying that animals, like flesh and blood animals and ghosts or supernatural beings, are the same thing. They're different kinds of beings, but the way that we interact with them and the experiences that we have through our kind of nervous system and things like that are kind of connecting processes, the same kinds of processes, even though the stimuli might be kind of different. So I kind of think, I kind of think like that.
It's interesting. I mean, there's an anthropological perspective, and please correct me because I'm, speaking out of turn here. I'm not an anthropologist. But like where people and cultures who encounter a phenomenon will define that phenomenon based on whatever cultural baggage they have that comes with them. So while they may be encountering the same sorts of things, they explain it different and experience it differently. And people would point to like, alien abduction versus fairy abduction 150 years ago or prior and say that maybe those are the same things, but we dress it up in whatever baggage we happen to bring with us. Do you think that that's true also, and how does that fit in with this?
I mean, it's a part of it, but it's also possible that there are fairies and aliens, and
Yeah,
that sometimes
exactly.
people have an encounter with fairies that isn't an encounter with extraterrestrials at all. It's an encounter with, a different kind of thing. But there might be similarities in terms of the processes or the phenomenological baggage that's attached to that encounter. So yeah, I think that there's entire we do definitely interpret things through our cultural lenses and all of that kind of stuff. It definitely happen. But that doesn't mean that the thing that we're interpreting is always exactly the same thing, all around the world and at different times throughout history. Sometimes we might encounter fairies, sometimes it might be a goblin from Mars, and sometimes it could be, I don't know, a spirit of a rock.
It's interesting to me that the phenomenologically it seems like that maybe we should have more faith in what witnesses report, but a lot of times we end up trying to be smarter on the back end and be like, oh well, let's think about what they really saw, as if they don't have the benefit of their own experience, and we want to tell them how they should be interpreting their own encounters. And that seems like a really arrogant way to approach these subjects, but then again, it's the only way that's largely accepted by most of academia, right?
Yeah,
I
and we have to
mean,
kind of catalog and classify certain kinds of experiences. Like that's a UFO experience, and that's a Bigfoot encounter, and that one's a goblin.
yeah. And I guess that, I mean, that quantification and analysis makes us feel more secure. Maybe that's really what's at root. But so, I mean, from your perspective, how do you think that paranormal experiences have helped shape our species and our culture? And why is it important for anthropology to have a better handle on what those things are doing for us?
I think the paranormal, paranormal experiences, or maybe we could talk more broadly about kind of extraordinary experiences,
Sure, yeah.
have shaped human civilizations, since the very beginning. We've just got to look at religion as one example. Like these vast kind of social and cultural movements and institutions that at their very kind of basis have this kind of experiential foundation, someone who's had an extraordinary encounter and who's interpreted it as a deity or whatever it is. So there's that way, but there's also the fact that these experiences are much more common than that model would often lead us to think. If we went down that route, we might think that only special people have extraordinary experiences, that only religious leaders have them. But actually, if you talk to anyone, we have all sorts of different kinds of experiences almost on a daily basis that kind of baffle us or challenge us, or that we think of as I don't know, luck, or all sorts of different things which are actually very relevant to our everyday kind of lived experience. And I think I think the paranormal and the extraordinary is actually much more normal and ordinary in a lot of ways. And that's part of the reason why anthropologists, should be taking it seriously. And it's not just normal and ordinary in one cultural context, it's across the board. It's normal and ordinary whether you're talking about mediums in suburban Bristol in the 21st century, or a shaman in 19th century Siberia. Vastly different contexts, similar kinds of ideas and beliefs. So that's reason enough for anthropologists to be interested in it.
Yeah.
But then there are other things as well, which are maybe more theoretical, like paranormal experiences and phenomena, like I was saying before, challenge our theories and encourage us to kind of push the limits of what our theorizing can do, and maybe also to come up with new kinds of theories. One example of that would be, in anthropology, most of the kind of theorizing about the nature of religion and spirituality and those kind of things has operated on the assumption that there is no such thing as magic or spirits or God or ghosts or anything. But
Yeah, that's
the
the
data,
predominant.
nothing,
Yeah.
the main view. But if the data from parapsychology is to be trusted, or if people's experiences are to be trusted, then there's much more going on than that.
Yeah.
If we started off our anthropology from the position that parapsychology demonstrates the reality of psi, this is something that an anthropologist called Michael Winkelmann said way back in 1982. But then we'd have to reconsider all of those dominant theories in anthropology through the lens of the reality of these phenomena. And that means then that, when shamans or medicine men or witch doctors or whatever have been doing their rituals, they've been tapping into a genuine phenomenon of psi. And it's not just a cultural system, or it's not just a kind of a belief system that's, faulty or irrational. But, it's actually practical techniques for engaging with a real human phenomenon.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's all sorts of reasons why anthropology should be to take the paranormal seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did an interview a little while ago, and they were talking about epistemic injustice, where basically we have a worldview that considers itself to be the gold standard in terms of refereeing what reality is and rejecting things based on the current state of our science and philosophy and whatnot. But if humans have really paid any attention to their own development over the past, 2,000 years, every thing that we think we know is only provisional, right? Everything is a theory, and nothing is ever really proven. So to turn that, quasi status of reality for things that we think that we have a handle on, into the, methods for judging the worth and reality of another system, seems like a bad idea, but that's the only way. Is that the only way to do anthropology, do you think? Is there a way that we could study other cultures and what they do, but not from a qualitative place, not from a we're the superior technologically advanced culture and we're gonna, examine the primitives or the natives or the savages, but rather be like, what are the examples of how human beings have learned to be in the world and what's useful about that? I mean, is that an approach we could take? I mean, or is that just soft-headed?
No, it's definitely an approach that can be taken. A lot of anthropology, historically, has been bound up with kind of a colonialist ideology, and the earliest anthropologists really were people like Evans Pritchard, who were hired by the British government to go out to Sudan to learn about people. Basically, so that they could be controlled better. And this is a legacy that has kind of run throughout a lot of anthropology. And even going back to the Victorian times, they had this evolutionist model of social evolution of human cultures, where you had primitive societies, and then at the very pinnacle you had, Victorian high society as the dominant worldview. And so these ideas have been kind of percolating within anthropology for a long time. But when people, and as I mentioned, Evans Pritchard there, he's not all bad. I mean, when he went to live with these people, he realized that, their worldviews were not irrational, that they were perfectly kind of modern human beings in every respect. They can provide food and do technology and all of these kinds of things, even though they have these kind of supernatural beliefs as well. So anthropologists gradually started to realize that those kind of imperialist colonial ideas of rationality and that kind of thing were totally kind of misplaced and misguided. And since then, there's been this whole movement towards the decolonization of anthropology, which is super interesting because, like you said, for the most part, anthropology has been people, usually from a Western, a white Western background, going to, I don't know, some tribe in the middle of nowhere and doing research on them, studying them, like as if in a lab or something like that. And now the table is turned, and there are ethnographies of cultures coming out of the cultures themselves. And really, when you think about it, who better to tell us about a culture than the people who live within that culture? So, there has been this kind of movement in anthropology towards that, and we're getting more and more anthropologists who are coming out from indigenous communities, all sorts of different places around the world, and writing from it about the world from their kind of perspective, which is really important.
Is that what's called the experiential source, approach, or how does that relate to, I mean?
The experiential source idea is that beliefs, like supernatural beliefs, not just supernatural beliefs, all sorts of things, really, science as well, I suppose. Ideas about the world are rooted in experiences that people have. And so that also applies to, paranormal beliefs or supernatural beliefs. David Hufford, the guy who came up with the term, basically said that he used the example of sleep paralysis and the old hag. And he said that, the old hag is like a cultural interpretation of an underlying core experience, which actually has a medical explanation, sleep paralysis. But it's something that happens across the board, and then people in different cultures have that same kind of experience and then label it differently. So one culture might label it as a witch, and another might label it as a hag or a demon or a monster or vampire. So that's the experiential source hypothesis.
We're going to take another break real quick, and then I want to come back and talk about shamanism and worldviews. So that should be interesting. Welcome back to the show. We're talking with Jack Hunter, anthropologist, about the paranormal and those sorts of things, worldviews that define how we live and exist in the world. I've just read The Archaic Revival by Terence McKenna, and he talks a lot about shamanism in that book, and how I mean, he's basically arguing that through the use of hallucinogens, like DMT or psilocybin, that we can engage with this numinous world, and it's a callback sort of to what he thinks the shamanistic cultures of human history did to kind of be more present with those things. And you mentioned that you had had an early psychedelic experience, and maybe that helped to turn you on to kind of the presence of these things, and then later on your own experiences. What are your thoughts about identifying a movement from the past like shamanism, right? And then all of a sudden, there's a resurrection of neo-shamanism in the world where there's groups that form up and try to reconstruct the approach as they can, and then try to live in that way. Do you feel like that's some kind of delayed cultural appropriation? Is that a something that you could potentially be useful for us to learn how to live in a more ecologically sound way on our planet? What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, there are many different strands to this issue. On the one hand, we can look to indigenous communities around the world, of different cultures, different societies, for kind of, for inspiration in a way. We can see the way that other people live and how they live in relationship with their natural environments, their natural resources. And we can say, are they living in a way that promotes biodiversity and sustainability and these kind of things, or are they living in a way that kind of goes in the opposite direction? And I think that can be a really useful thing. The troubles start to come in really when you say that we're going to take this specific practice from this particular group of people and then transplant it from that place into this place. And there's all sorts of things that are problematic about doing that. One, if we're talking about sort of like, I don't know, like agricultural techniques or something, there's this big problem of the habitat and the climate and things like that. What works in one part of the world doesn't necessarily work in another one. And this is a problem on the other side of things as well, with monocultures and industrial farming impinging on indigenous and local communities, implanting one way of doing things onto a world where there are many ways of doing things. So, it's problematic to take ideas from one place and transplant them to another, whether we're doing it like taking ideas from indigenous people or implanting our own ideas onto them as well. But there are ways, and we can look back into our own Western histories to find very similar kinds of ideas and practices, but that are rooted in these lands that we live in. And again, like I was saying before about, I'm not saying that the practices of the ancient Celts were identical to the practices of indigenous, South Americans or North Americans or anything like that, but there are kind of underlying similarities or processes or ways of understanding the world that are kind of similar to that. So one thing that we can do really is look back to into our own traditions, and we don't have to look that far. I mean, really, you only have to look into folklore. It's only one little step into folklore, and all of a sudden, a whole other worldview opens up. A worldview where, plants and animals communicate with human beings or can talk, or where there are different kinds of forces active in the world, powerful forces of good and evil and things like that, where there are spirits that inhabit caves and rocks. And all of these ideas, we've relegated them to folklore, really, and we think of folklore as something that's outdated and an old way of understanding the world. But they give us a real, I think they give us a real framework for an animate world. And the more that I dig into my local folklore, I've just written a book about the folklore of the Tanat Valley, where I live in Wales. The more this sort of animate model of reality kind of comes out of it. Whether the mountains are alive, or the mountains are inhabited by fairies and giants and things like that. So yeah, I think we don't have to take from other cultures even. We can look to them as examples of lived examples, but we have our own traditions and cultural models that are relevant to us, which can serve the same kind of purpose.
What would you say? I mean, when like whether it's ours or it's another culture's, folklore or history or cultural approach, what is to your mind valuable and that contrasts with what we're currently living in and doing? Why, what could we gain by kind of re-examining human history and looking for another way to be? What would you say, in your own opinion, obviously, that maybe we need?
Yeah, well, I think a part of it is the recognition of the sentience of the world around us. A big part of our Western materialist kind of industrial capitalist worldview is that we're basically human beings are the only sentient or truly sentient beings, intelligent beings, and all other life on Earth is really, for us to exploit, taken to ex its kind of extreme example. And the worldview that you find when you look at indigenous cultures, doesn't matter where you are in the world. And obviously, it's hard to talk in very broad brushstrokes about huge swathes of cultures very different from each other. But that, again, there are certain patterns that keep kind of recurring more often than not. And they are things like recognizing the personhood of plants and animals, or of the natural world, the sentience of the world. Anthropologists talk, they used to think of animism. Animism is an anthropological term. It was coined by E.B. Tyler, who I mentioned before, and he used to think of it as a primitive mentality. It was evidence of a faulty logic and faulty rationality that's been superseded by science and stuff. But now anthropologists understood that idea that the world is alive as a relational ontology. It's the idea that, it's a model of the world where relationships and establishing beneficial relationships with other beings, not all of whom are human beings, so plant and animal beings, relationships are the building blocks of reality. In our culture, contrasted to that, it's all about individuality. It's not about building relationships with people and establishing communities. It's about asserting our own celebrity in a way, making ourselves into, strongly individuated human beings. I think one thing we can learn from these other traditions and also from our ancestors, is that, communities are important. And I'm not just talking about human communities, living in a good community with our natural environment so that we're not depleting our, natural habitats, so that biodiversity doesn't go down when we live in a place, but it goes up, it increases, and we're doing something positive. Indigenous communities have been living in, for thousands of years, where they haven't been moved by Western European colonialist, forces. In not always in harmony and not always in balance, but certainly much doing much better than, our kind of industrial scale logging of the Amazon rainforest and all of that kind of stuff, or the wholesale kind of chopping down of trees in Britain, in the medieval times. We've not done so well. So I think there's a lot that we can learn from indigenous and other worldviews. And
I
it's about
totally
sentience, yeah, personhood.
passionately agree with you. I couldn't agree more. My question, though, the next question for me is, what is necessary for a society or culture to have its worldview evolve dramatically? Like, you've studied lots of different cultures. Is it ever a choice? And if it's not a choice, what is it that makes one a culture pivot? Is it only due to conquest or mass die-offs, catastrophe? And that seems like what gets pointed at as the only real engines that can make people shift on a massive scale to an entirely different way of being, which seems like is what it is what's called for in this moment, because the planet seems to be struggling and dying as
Yeah.
we continue to, usurp all the resources.
It's a tricky one. I mean, I always get a bit sort of edgy when it comes to, puts me on edge to think about this idea of having to sort of change lots of people to change a world view of people. Because to me, again, that starts to sound a little bit kind of colonial, doesn't it? To
Yeah,
change people.
fascistic, making people think a certain way, right? I mean,
Okay. But I think that the real power of change doesn't kind of come from, it doesn't necessarily work like that. You can't tell
yeah.
people to do things, really. It doesn't often work. But people can come to their own conclusions about things. And I think, psychedelics is an interesting example. There's all sorts of research on the way that psychedelics change people on an individual basis. Towards, I don't know, there's some interesting stuff about what's it called? Pro-environmental behavior and e connection to nature and those kinds of things that come about after even sort of one psychedelic session. And these can be kind of lasting changes. There's another thing that we see with paranormal experiences as well.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. It seems to waken people up to those ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. So, there are these kind of individual changes which are much more authentic
Yeah.
than trying to impose anything on anyone. People realize these things themselves. I think what we need to think about doing is enabling the opportunity to access these kinds of extraordinary experiences. And
Doesn't need drinking water. Just
I don't necessarily
kidding.
mean that that's one way of doing it, but you have to be willing and
Yes.
But it doesn't have to be psychedelics, or it doesn't have to be intense ritual. There's all sorts of studies about engagement with open wild spaces or in forests or in wilderness and things like that. And people can have, like I was saying before, just as profound a kind of shift in their worldview as having an encounter with a flesh and blood cat or a tree, just as much as they might do encountering an alien or a spirit or a ghost. So giving people access to open spaces, I think will automatically, at least for some people, trigger experiences of connection to the natural world. And then, so it'd be a gradual thing. It won't be like a big revolution. But then again, we've been saying these kinds of things for 50 years or so, if not 100 years. And we're in probably even worse a situation now as we've ever been.
And the need
So.
just gets more and more acute, and people seem to realize that this kind of change is necessary, but we don't seem to have the motivation to get there. And it's a hard question because we want to balance freedom, obviously, liberty, with the need to kind of react to a changing planet. And how do you accommodate that without causing loads of unrest or that's a very, very difficult conversation. But one thing you mentioned earlier about, like, with the paranormal and other things where it kind of confronts you potentially with the sentience of the environment, right? Or like nature and other animals and plants. I sometimes entertain the idea that all of these things are signals from nature. Like, nature is embodied in paranormal phenomenon, whether it's whether it's an entity, a whole unto itself, or it's just the signals that kind of come through all these different individual manifestations of things. But we're confronted with that message over and over and over again, whether it's from aliens or whether it's from near-death experiences or all these different kind of happenings, all point to us becoming better, more responsible inhabitants on planet Earth. And that consistency of message makes me wonder if it's all, our planet trying to give us that transitional personal moment to begin to, pivot. Thoughts?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, again, it could go in either direction. It could be that there is a kind of a Gaia kind of idea that a planet has a sentience to itself, and I do think it most likely does. But again, it's made up of many different parts. But it also could be, again, that it's a kind of our innate human capacity for this kind of relationship with the natural world that is activated. So there are certain situations that we get in, whether it's psychedelics or in wilderness or with an alien or whatever it is, that activates that human capacity for deep empathy with the natural world. So it doesn't have to, again, it doesn't have to be coming from a single source. There can be many sources that trigger this thing that's actually innate within us, that's a human capacity. I wouldn't want to say that it's a purely human capacity. I think probably we'd find empathy out in the world in all sorts of different places as well. But yeah, it's not necessarily that there is a Gaia consciousness that's changing us, but we might have an interaction with just a frog or something that changes us. But it's the same, it's the thing that's triggered in us that's important. I don't know which way it goes. I think probably is a bit of both as usual. That I think there probably is a big Gaia sentience, but there's also something in us that is special that we kind of can be switched on and off with certain kinds of experiences.
Amazing. So we're going to take a final break. When we come back, we'll dive a little bit deeper into the future before his work. So we'll be right back. So we're back on Dreamland, and you mentioned a few minutes ago that you had just finished a new book, The Folklore of Tennet Valley. And I'm really you live in Wales, right? And to me, I don't know if you've ever read Susan Cooper's The Dark Knight or The Dark, what's it called again? Oh, geez, I'm going to regret this. Anyway, there's a book by this author named Susan Cooper. She wrote a series of them, and I think they were Welsh, or they took place in Wales, and they involve a lot of folklore. So I have this notion of of Wales as being, sort of mist-soaked, droopy branched trees with like kind of ghost, and crawly, it just the typical kind of idea of what the folklore brings to mind. So can you tell us about your book? Why did you take it on? What did you find out, and what makes it so captivating for you?
Well, first of all, the kind of characterization of Wales is kind of accurate in a lot of places. It's quite a rural place, and there are mountains and rivers, valleys are important, but there are also urban areas, especially down in South Wales. It's much more rugged kind of up north, and in the middle, and then most of the people live down south in the cities. And where I live, the Tanat Valley is it's kind of I think of it as South North Wales or North Mid Wales. It's kind of like between places. And the Tanat Valley is kind of on the border with England. So lots of people think of it as a kind of a gateway into Wales. It's a valley that runs pretty much east west. So you come in from England and then you go straight into the heart of Wales along this valley, and it goes up into the mountains. And if you keep going, you get to the Irish Sea. So the Tanat Valley is a place where people have been moving through for going back thousands of years. There's archaeological remains from the Iron Age and even Bronze Age burials. There are standing stones and stone circles in the hills. And there's a rich kind of heritage of Celtic saints. Pretty much every village in the area is named after a different saint. They all have the saint's name as a part of the name of the village. So it's kind of always been steeped in magic and, history, religion, all these kind of things. And it's kind of, captivated me. I mentioned my psychedelic experiences. All of these things, these kind of pivotal experiences that I had, apart from with the seance groups, have happened in the Tanat Valley. For a long time, I was kind of disappointed because I would try to find stories from the area, interesting stories, and I couldn't find anything. There's a few stories that are really well known and quite popular. So, for example, there's a story about a dragon. In Llanrhaidr y Mochnant, one of the villages here, where the dragon was killed when they put up a big standing stone with spikes attached to it, and they put a red sheet over this standing stone, and the dragon flew into it and coiled around it and killed itself on the stone. That's a well-known story around here, and it's even painted on the primary school, gable end of the primary school. So, I knew about that, and I knew stories about Saint Melangell. She's a local saint who came from Ireland, and she was escaping from an arranged marriage, basically. And she arrived here. This is sort of in the 600s, so quite a long time ago. And she found this valley near where we live here, the Tanat Valley, where she sort of set up a sanctuary, and she was there, kind of living a life of prayer and devotion away from Ireland and away from all of that royal life. And then one day the local prince was riding through the area, and he was chasing a hare with his hunting party, and they came to a clearing in the woods, and they found Malangeth in prayer there, and the hare went and hid underneath her skirt. And the prince was so kind of overwhelmed by this vision of this pious woman and the hare taking shelter there that he declared the whole valley a sanctuary. So all of these kind of stories that are well-known ones, but I could never find anything to do with thing, weirder stuff like fairies and
Fairy
things. Not for a
sightings and
lot.
whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. Not for quite a long time. And that's interesting because my sister had a fairy experience when she was growing up, where she had been. For some reason, I can't remember why, she was sleeping on the floor in my bedroom on a mattress on the floor. And she woke up in the night and said that she saw this little man kind of in green clothes dancing on the shelf. And he had red hair and pointy ears and the classic kind. She said, it was a leprechaun. That's how she described So that there were these kind of hints of something, but I could never find anything in the literature. And then one day, my friend Eric gave me a, and he's actually the one who's publishing this folklore book for me now. And he has a small record label and imprint called Plenty Wenlock Records, and they're publishing. Anyway, he gave me this book that he'd found called A Wanderer in North Wales, which was written by a guy called John Cledwyn Hughes, who he grew up in a village in the Tanat Valley called Llansanfraid. And in this book, he has this lovely sort of gothic writing style, and he described his adventures walking around North Wales in the 1940s. And he specifically mentions the Tanat Valley. And this was the thing that Eric gave me this book, and I was like, oh my God, there's some interesting stuff here. And he talked about associations with the fairies. He talked about a connection to Gwynap Nudd, and the Wild Hunt. Gwynap Nudd is actually one of the kind of the king of the fairies in Welsh folklore. And he described people seeing the Wild Hunt up on the mountains, bright flashes of light, and hearing hunting horns and all of this kind of stuff. And this was the book that kind of it triggered me to look to dig deeper and see what I could find. And I sort of started to look through, all of the folklore books that I could find. And I noticed that there were bits about the Tanat Valley in lots of different books, but nothing that had brought all of them together into one place. So that's what I decided to do, was to kind of bring all of these different bits together. And I found lots of interesting stuff about fairies, which I had no real idea of. I found out that the mountain that I spent most of my childhood on as a child was a fairy mountain,
What does that
where
mean
there was
exactly?
it's an Iron Age hill fort. But it's a place where the fairies lived. There are caves on the mountain. There's a story about miners going into the mountain and meeting a fairy washerwoman, all of this kind of stuff. As a child, me and my cousins spent a lot of time on this mountain making up sort of Lord of the Rings style rip-off stories, but making maps of the mountain and saying this was a place where the fairies lived, this is where the elves are and the dwarves are over there and stuff. And little did we know that, people have been doing that about the mountain for hundreds of years going
And it's
back.
hard to imagine a more perfect
And I
setting
just
for
say
that kind
one.
of. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll just mention one other interesting thing that really kind of clinched it, this whole thing for me. So I know I mentioned my sister seeing this little dancing man. I found a story from 200 years ago, so it's like the 1800s this event happened, from a village that's about 9 miles down the road from where my family house is. And in the story, there's a man. He wakes up in his bedroom at night. He sees a little man dancing on the end of his bed, and he sees a little da circle of dancing fairies on the floor in the room. And he asks the fairies in Welsh. He asks them what they are and what they're doing there. And they said, "We are spirits of the air." The word that they use is ysbrydion yr awyr, which is spirits of the air in Welsh. And the guy goes on. This is a kind of a theme in lots of these Welsh folk stories. He confronts them and he says, "If you don't, clear off, then I'm going to tell the landlord," and all of this kind of stuff. And eventually, the fairies kind of disappear. But the thing that I found so interesting was that I had no idea of this story of a guy waking up in his room, meeting and having an encounter with a fairy 9 miles down the road from my house. And my sister had pretty much exactly the same experience about 200 years later. And so, it makes you wonder whether these things are kind of still active in some way in the valley. So my approach to it is also to think of it as a sort of paranormal landscape that is probably still active if we engage with it in a certain kind of way.
I love that. Personally, for yourself, I mean, as someone who has lived there, been raised there, and now you've done this research and you're finding the folklore and it, I mean, how does that serve, do you think, to connect you better to your own environment, and how does it change the way you think about location in turn or place in your life? I mean, you have kids too, right?
Yeah,
So does
yeah.
that, I mean, I mean, how does all that sort of form up?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, when you know the stories, this is one of the things that I've really noticed is that they are all of the stories that I've found are intimately connected to place. And the place where they occurred is often mentioned, in very specific detail. So they might be describing a particular location or a particular standing stone, for example, which is obvious. But they also these stories also pinpoint, places where dragons lived and where the nest is. So you could kind of go to those places. And I think once you know the stories that are attached to the places, a different relationship is established. And you can tell your kids the story of the dragon and tell them where the dragon's nest is. And then when you pass that place and you're driving past in a car, it means something to them, straight away. I think, that's one of the ways that, it points us in the direction of connection, relationship, with the landscape. Yeah. Even the ghost stories around here, they obviously ghosts are often attached to very particular houses. So you can pinpoint where these events occurred. I found a great book that was hanging around in my parents' house for many, many years, called Memories of Old Llangynog. And Llangynog is the village where I grew up. And I've never really looked in that book until literally the other day. And I thought, oh, I'll just have a quick look in this book and see what's in there. And I found a little paragraph where the author, he was an old guy in the village. He wrote the book in the year 2000. So he was reflecting back to the 1940s and 50s. And he mentioned these specific places where there were supposed to be ghosts or spirits. And he just mentioned them in passing, but the exact locations of where they are. So he's like, maybe there's a ghost by the old tunnel at blah, blah, blah. Maybe there's a spirit by, the hill, whatever it is. So there is a what I'm think what I'm calling like I've been calling it a fairy topography. That there's a like a layer of stories and narratives and experiences that is not implanted on the land, but actually comes out of the land. And that's I think that's what I've kind of, or I haven't been able to sort of map it completely, but I think what I have done is a good step in the right direction to mapping this kind of a fairy topography of the Tanat Valley. And maybe in the future someone else can take the project forward and really make a complete one.
It's interesting that you mentioned story and narrative and how that ties into this. I mean, that seems like it ties into a lot of what, the anomalous experiences, the value of them, whether they helped form myth or holy books in the past, or fairy tales that were passed down through generations. The power of that story, I mean, I can't say that I know that they one manifests the other, but it seems like there's a deep connection there about, how we end up feeling about our own location, our own background, our own ancestry, and these stories that collect, and the magic that is imbibing the world as a whole. It's like through these stories we get connection to our planet, and maybe that's part of the value of these experiences and the message that we're supposed to be getting, that through odd experiences that we pass on, we develop a more respectful relationship with place.
Yeah. I mean, people like Jeffrey Kripal and Joshua Kutchin
Yeah,
suggest
exactly.
that there's a kind of fiction is a kind of fundamental process within all of this, and narrative is a part of the way that the whole thing kind of operates. And you can use ideas from, critical ideas from literary studies and things like that to kind of unpick and disentangle paranormal experiences, which I think is a really interesting kind of aspect of it. But the other thing interesting about it as well is the way that these experiences, like you said, generate new stories, they generate new narratives. And we have in our culture now a kind of aversion to a lot of these kinds of experiences. If we had an experience with a fairy, and this is what happened with me when I had my psychedelic fairy experience, I told my mum about it the next day, and she's not like anti any of this stuff at all, but And at that time, probably for other reasons as well, maybe because I was, taking mushrooms and whatever. But I had this kind of reaction response to the experience. It was like, oh, you saw fairies. Yeah. There are certain kinds of things that you're not allowed, certain kinds of experiences you're not allowed to have. And I think people are reluctant to talk about their encounters. The story is generated in the encounter, but it is sort of stalled or held back because people don't want to tell those stories. And I think if people start to tell the stories again, in their local communities and their families, then that connection to place will build up again. People say, "Oh, I had a strange experience down on the Green Lane, for example." Oh, interesting. Yeah, I've got to remember that place. It has a story attached to it, a meaning attached to it.
I love that, and the cultivation of that is a way for all of us to reconnect with our homes, which is beautiful. Well, excellent, man. I think that's pretty much what I've got for you. What do you have planned coming up for the future of your work and research? Have you got a new direction picked out, or are you content now that you've just finished a book to kind of not be working too hard right
Well,
now?
there's a few things. No, it never stops.
Of course.
I've got lots of interesting teaching coming up. I'm teaching a course for the California Institute of Human Sciences on the varieties of anomalous experience. I'm teaching courses for the Aleph Trust on approaches to consciousness, and for the Sophia Center on sacred geography and ecology and spirituality. And I've got a book project that's kind of bubbling away in the background about non-human consciousness, which I really need to get finished. And also a new kind of research strand to do with local cunning men or cunning folk, conjurers and that kind of thing. I've been given access to some amazing material objects from magical kind of middens in a local house here. It's full of interesting things. And one project that I've only really just started talking about today, but might be to kind of try to catalogue some of these magical and ritual objects,
What are
wands,
they
and
exactly, if you don't mind?
there seems to be a wand. There's all sorts of objects. It's like a bent razor blades and apotropaic for warding off evil spirits and things like that.
So cool.
Piles of walnuts and children's toys deposited in the house, hagstones and things like that. So yeah, I think it's some sort of pictorial project that documents these objects would be quite fun.
No, that would be amazing. Fascinating. And when you say cunning folk, that's sort of like a sorcerer, right? Like a mage, but maybe a little bit darker than that. Is that correct?
Well, more like most in Wales, they call a dyn hysbys, which means like a cunning man, and they were also women as well. And for the most part, they kind of they lived in the community. They would have normal jobs for the most part as well. Like one was a weaver, and they might be a bricklayer or something like that, or a potter. But then they have this kind of other job, which is to maybe capture spirits. There's lots of stories around here of spirits being captured in bottles and things like that, in jars, and then or in matchboxes, and then buried in fields. Or they might be able to find lost objects and stuff like that. So they were kind of like the wise person in the village. And some of them would also get up to other kinds of stuff that was a bit more suspicious, like summoning spirits, ritual magic, and those kind of things as well. There's all sorts of amazing stuff. They found a cunning man's kind of magical spell book, essentially made up of all spells from different traditions, like can't think of off the top of my head at the moment, but basically like bits from John Dee and other places, all kind of handwritten and put together into a useful book. So there's
Grimoire.
certain kinds of exactly grimoire. with specific remedies for certain things or specific kinds of conjurations for particular situations. So yeah, that's something that I've been digging into a lot recently. It's a kind of an extension of the folklore research I've been doing.
Do you is that a living tradition at all, or is that only something that was long?
Yeah,
Who knows, right?
interesting. Well, I think, in some way, some of these traditions have kind of disappeared. But there was an interesting one on Anglesey, which is a big island at the top of North Wales, where the Romans chased the Druids there. It was the last kind of stronghold of the Druid. And there was this kind of local magical tradition on the island that incorporated the Celtic stone heads that they found there that was still active up until, I think, into the sort of 1990s. And there was this sort of one guy who was the last custodian of this tradition. And I think he handed over his sort of artifacts to the museum. So, that it's possible that there are other such groups out there that continue these practices. But by nature, they would be difficult to find because they'd be very secretive and very local. But yeah, it'd be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be so fascinating, man. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir, for a fantastic conversation. Just like last time, I appreciate you so deeply.
Thank you very much.
Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Streber. I'm Whitley Streber, your host for Dreamland.